Michael and I do not coordinate on music, but the first song that he had is what I'm talking about. God does things like that. I was reading Rabbi Sacks, and he had an article called The Closeness of God, and the whole question is, what is going on in Exodus 33? Those of you who have been here for more than 20 minutes know that Exodus is a chiasm. The golden calf and the tent of meeting are right in the middle of the chiasm. And so as Sacks is talking about this, he says things seem out of order and so forth, and really need to explain what's going on. Now, Rabbi Sacks was a great scholar, so I'm sure he absolutely knows that he's in a chiasm, but that's not the way he chose to present it. Let's talk about the tent of meeting and what's going on. So I'll give you an overview of the chiasm. It starts off with the Ten Commandments of Mount Sinai. Then we have instructions to build the tabernacle. Then we have the golden calf. Then we have the tabernacle. Now, this is genealogy, but I think it's absolutely correct. There's three 40-day periods. They start off with the Ten Commandments of Mount Sinai. Moses goes up the mountain for 40 days. And we read today where he comes down and finds the golden calf, breaks the tablets, goes into the tent of meeting, and he stays there for 40 days. Then he goes back up the mountain again for another 40 days. He gets the second set of tablets and comes down. So what we have at the beginning is Shavuot, where we have the Ten Commandments, and at the end we have Yom Kippur. So those are the two bookends of this chiasm. It is my belief that the negotiation that goes on in the tent of meeting was the place where God decided, we'll make a tabernacle so I can go with you. And so on the second trip up is where he got the instructions and plans on how to build it, comes down and starts to build it after Yom Kippur. So that's the sequence of events that happened on the ground. And of course, in lots of Hebrew scripture, chiasm is a way of emphasizing things. So what they're doing is emphasizing, you have the tabernacle here, golden calf in the middle. So let's talk about now what's going on in the tent of meeting, that 40-day period, which is what Sacks was talking about. We read today that when Moses comes down and destroys the golden calf, he grinds it into powder and makes everybody drink it. And the next thing that happens is all of the people took off their ornaments. What I believe is going on there is this is a precursor to the ceremony for a wife who is suspected of infidelity, where she has to come into the temple and they write a curse on parchment and scrape it off and make her drink it. So the idea of taking this golden calf and breaking it up and making everybody drink it is, if you will, a precursor to the ceremony of the Sotah. Their ornaments removed, I will suggest to you, is she has taken off her wedding ring. So the metaphor is, you are suspected of adultery, take off your wedding rings, and we'll decide then what's going to happen. So what Moses is doing in the tent of meeting is he is negotiating with God about whether God himself is going to go with this people or whether God is going to stay up on the mountain and send an angel before them. That's what the negotiation is all about. And the whole scenario, if you will, revolves around this concept of infidelity. Is he going to forgive their infidelity and go with them, or is he going to send them out with nothing but an angel? So this whole thing revolves around faithfulness, covenant, and the human equivalent would be marriage between a man and a wife. So let me read you from Sacks now. If it was as Moses was saying, until now, they have experienced you as a terrifying elemental force, delivering plague after plague to the Egyptians, bringing the world's greatest empire to its knees, dividing the sea, overturning the very order of nature itself, At Mount Sinai, merely hearing your voice, they were so overwhelmed that they said, if we continue to hear the voice, we will die. The people needed, said Moses, to experience not the greatness of God, but the closeness of God. Not God heard in thunder and lightning at the top of the mountain, but God is a perpetual presence in the valley below. Sachs's point of view is what Moses is saying is, everybody knows that you are the God of the universe. You have demonstrated that absolutely. And people are terrified. So what is really needed now is your presence. You have to be with us, not as this terrible voice that nobody can hear, but as someone that we can be family with. Having God travel with them as a family, as opposed to this cosmic force that terrifies everybody. Israel, as you all remember, was designated as God's firstborn. The first implies that there's going to be more. And then the second part of that is, the firstborn is a member of the family. It is not just some random person out there. The firstborn is a member of the family, and God is the father, and they come to regard him as a father. But up until now, they have not seen him that way. They have only seen this massive cosmic force that is able to do all sorts of things, and boy, we got that. We understand. But we're not seeing you as a father. And what Moses is negotiating for in the tent of meeting is, in order for this to work, you have got to be among us as a constant presence so that we can travel with you and get to know you, not as cosmic force, but intimately as a family. One of the things that is interesting here is Moses said, if you know me and I know you, I want to see your face. And God says, nope, that's not going to work. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you my glory. And at the end of Exodus, what happens is the glory of God descends on the tabernacle. And the glory of God on the tabernacle is such that Moses cannot go inside until that lifts a little bit. One of the things that Sachs is talking about is lots of nations worship God. Christians worship God. We worship the same God they do, and he acknowledges that. But, he says, Hebrews are unique because Hebrews not only worship him as Elohim, they also worship him as a father, as members of the family. And in that, they are unique. And that's where I disagree with Rabbi Sachs. Now, Rabbi Sachs was not a Christian. He was not Messianic. He was great Jewish, brilliant man. I respect him a great deal. One of the things that you'll remember as we read the Gospels is Yeshua is constantly duking it out with the Pharisees. And one of the things that he keeps going after them for is their exclusivity. He gets criticized because he's eating with sinners, tax collectors, and so forth. You can't do that. He says, the ones who need a physician are the ones who are sick. Sure, I'm going to eat with them. And then after the resurrection, you remember Peter goes to see Cornelius. And when he gets back to Jerusalem, he just gets raked sideways by everybody else because it is not lawful for you to go and eat in the house of a Gentile. On a practical matter, what that has done is it has prevented assimilation. Because as Jews and Hebrews mix with other societies, in fact, one of the big deals after the Babylonian captivity is the Jews come back from Babylon and they immediately start intermarrying with the pagans around there. And both Ezra and Nehemiah have to say, no, you can't be doing that. And the whole point there is you are supposed to be unique and you are not to assimilate. I will suggest to you, however, that that set of instructions potentially could have changed after the cross. The reason for not wanting to assimilate is because you need to be an identifiable people because my son is going to be born into you. So if you look just like everybody else and nobody knows who you are, when my son is born, there won't be anything special. Nobody will notice. Whereas if you are an identifiable people that I have kept over the centuries, which he did, and I took you to Babylon, I brought you back, so that my son could be born among you. The resurrection from the dead, Yeshua, is again a first fruits. I'm in John 1. The true light, which enlightens everyone, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. But all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. The family is expanding. The family from Sinai, or from Egypt actually, up until the birth of Christ was Hebrews. After that, the family expanded. Read you another one from Colossians. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. And remember I said the idea of firstborn is there are more coming. If there's not going to be a second one, then it's unique as opposed to the first. For by him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead. Second firstborn. Firstborn of all creation, firstborn from the dead, which is talking then about resurrection. That in everything he might be preeminent, for in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of the cross. So he is the firstborn, he is making peace, and then if we go to Ephesians 3:1. For this reason, I, Paul, a prisoner for Christ, Yeshua, on behalf of you Gentiles. He's writing to Gentiles now. That's important because John was talking about Hebrews. For this reason, I, Paul, a prisoner for Christ, Yeshua, on behalf of you Gentiles, assuming that you have heard of the stewardship of God's grace that was given to me for you, how the mystery was made known to me by revelation, as I have written briefly. When you read this, you can perceive my insight into the mystery of Christ. Notice he said mystery twice, which was not made known to the sons of men in other generations, as it has now been revealed to his holy apostles and prophets by the Spirit. So this is a spiritual revolution after the resurrection. This mystery is that the Gentiles are fellow heirs, members of the same body, and partakers of the promise in Messiah Yeshua through the gospel. What has happened then when Yeshua is raised from the dead is the Gentiles are now able to become part of the family, which they were not before. And then just to finish the set, 1 Corinthians 2, verse 6 through 8. Yet among the mature we do impart wisdom, although it is not a wisdom of this age or of the rulers of this age who are doomed to pass away. What he's talking about is principalities and powers. But we impart a secret and hidden wisdom of God. Remember we were talking about mysteries back in Ephesians. This is a mystery. We impart a secret and hidden wisdom of God, which God decreed before the ages for our glory. None of the rulers of this age understood that. If they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. And that takes you, of course, to the parable of the absent owner and the vineyard. And the absent owner makes a vineyard, leases it out to tenants, and goes on a long trip. And then he sends back and says, all right, give me some of the fruit. And they beat his servants, they kill some of them, and so forth. And finally he says, I will send my son. They will respect him. And when the tenants see the son coming, they say, aha, this is the heir. Let's kill him. And then the vineyard will belong to us. And that's what Paul is talking about here in Corinthians. The principalities and powers looked at him and said, aha, the heir. If we kill him, then the vineyard, the world, will belong to us. And what they didn't realize was by doing that, they had magnified their problem. Before, their problem was just the Jews or the Hebrews. Now their problem is potentially all of humanity. Because all of humanity now has the ability to become part of the family of God, which did not exist before. So, Rabbi Sacks did a very nice job. Didn't agree with his conclusion, but still like him a lot. What's going on in Exodus 33? He is basically negotiating with God. How are you going to interact with your people? Are you going to continue to be this voice up on the top of the mountain that terrifies everybody? Or are you going to come down here and live with us? And when you come down here and live with us, the relationship is different. And that's what Moses is negotiating for in 33. As I say, I don't coordinate with Mike on the music. And so the fact that he chose that song as the opening song was kind of fun.